Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG. Coming up on this Monday edition, we had a stormy weekend here in Oklahoma, and parts of the U.S. did as well. Weekend storms leave 14 dead across the U.S. The New York Times is facing a wave of criticism after a climate change column. Interesting story. We'll take a look at that. Also, prioritizing three things will improve your life and maybe even save it. And the Royal Navy to lose amphibious capabilities. That and more. Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG, online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. You can also listen on the TuneIn app if you have that, or other places, I'm sure, but those are some of them. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Urge, and Abraham Blondo here today. You can follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm and send any comments you might have to comments at kpcg.fm. We had a lot of rain this weekend. You guys get flooded out, flooded away?
I was okay at my house. But it was Sunday morning. It was weird because I looked outside and it was cloudy. A minute later, I looked out, it was sunny. Then a minute later, it was hailing.
That's Oklahoma for you. You're going to have those extremes. Yeah, Sunday morning was kind of odd like that. It was partly sunny, but raining at the same time, but doing all these things. Friday night, a lot of storms. Saturday, quite a few storms. Sunday, not so bad. Cold Sunday, it was only like 50 degrees, which is pretty cold for Oklahoma in the end of April, I guess. And but it was a stormy weekend in parts of the U.S. This is a write-up from Fox News. Says Midwest South recovering after weekend storm. Storms leave 14 dead. So we had a lot of rain. I didn't know that it was that severe, but some places were. Tornadoes hit several small towns in East Texas, killing 4 people. Flooding and winds killed 5 people in Arkansas, including a fire chief who was struck by a vehicle while working during the storm. 2 deaths were reported in Missouri, including a woman who drowned after rushing water swept away her car. 1 of 2 deaths in Mississippi included a 7-year-old who died by electric shock, and a 2-year-old girl died in Tennessee after being struck by a soccer goal blown by the heavy winds. So just odd ways. It's always interesting. There are just really strange ways people die in some of these storms.
Yeah, how do all those things happen in such a short amount of time? That really is rare to even just have one of those occurrences, but to have a few at the same time is even more rare.
So many odd things that can happen there, but flooding can be a big problem. I mean, even just driving around here, there's certain areas that don't drain as well, and they weren't too far from flooding over the streets. So I didn't see that myself. I didn't see any like flood waters coming anywhere, but if we had had much more rain, we probably would have had something.
We've had that here on campus recently a couple times where the water is just flowing through the roads just because we've gotten so much at one time.
Yeah, downpour. Why can't we be more moderate in this state? Just a gentle rain. It seems like it comes in buckets.
Well, actually, I saw some Twitter pictures because the news or the police department, fire departments post pictures of intersections when they're flooded. And all along Portland, just further west of where we are, like about 4 or 5 miles, there all the intersections were flooded under a few feet of water.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so they had to close all those down, and they showed some cars and they were stuck there. And Missouri too, some places were so flooded that they were over tops of cars.
Yeah,
and then the next day it's normal because all the water went downstream. It's just amazing.
Yeah, so pretty stormy weekend, and I think those storms are heading east, so they might have some storms today. But quite a bit of rain, quite a bit of hail Saturday night. I woke up hearing that slamming the roof, thinking about my insurance. wondering how, if it did any damage, to our garden, our little plants. They got smashed by the hail, so that time of year. And then we almost had a frost. And then somebody was telling me there was snow up in the panhandle, which I didn't see myself, but I heard there was quite a bit up there.
Yeah. There was in Kansas, too. They had snow And in our garden up front, we had one tulip come up, one brilliant red tulip. It came up. My wife was cheering it on every day. And then we had like winds, hail, storms. And now it's just shredded on the front garden part. So it didn't last long.
They were all under the dirt. And the one's like, I think I'm going to make a break for it. And they're like, no, don't do it. It's too dangerous.
But it's almost May.
Yeah. He learned a valuable lesson. He was destroyed. Well, of course, anytime you start talking about weather, one of the things that pops into people's mind probably is climate change. That's always a huge issue. And CNN has this write-up about how the New York Times faces a wave of criticism over climate column. They have, and it was the guy's first column for the Times, probably his last. I don't know. I mean, maybe it's good to be controversial. But he kind of threw a little bit of maybe caution at the way people go about the climate change data. And I don't know how many people are upset, but they're making it out to seem like a lot of people are upset that he would doubt potentially the climate change data.
Was this Brett Stevens?
Yes.
Okay, because on my Twitter, I saw an outburst of things with his name in it, and I didn't really understand what was going on. But
yeah,
I saw some stories about this over the weekend.
They say in his first column for the Times, Brett Stevens said, advocates for climate policy can take a lesson from Hillary Clinton's failed presidential campaign and her reliance on data to predict the election. And I'm not sure if Brett Stevens is pro or con climate change, but I think he brings up a good point. Just kind of a good common sense point, but people didn't like it. He says this. This is from his column. We live in a world, by the way, there's some words in here which you might need a dictionary for, but we'll just plow through it. We live in a world in which data convey authority, he says, but authority has a way of descending into certitude, and certitude begets hubris. So in other words, they're so sure of the data that they get a little arrogant about it. He said, claiming total certainty about the science traduces the spirit of science and creates openings for doubt whenever a climate claim proves wrong. So his point is, don't be so confident that you know the answer. And I think that's a great point.
Well, isn't it strange how people are so confident in climate change when just recently it was called global warming? Now it's not always warming, so they're changing it to climate change to also account for extremely cold temperatures that are taking place as well. It's really like they're following it blindly as a faith.
Yeah, and I think, as he says here, claiming total certainty about the science traduces the spirit of science and creates openings for doubt. I mean, the whole idea is that they're investigating and trying to find out and trying to, I don't know if you'd say experiment in this case, but they're looking at the data. And to be absolutely so certain that you are right, there is no chance you could in any way be wrong. I mean, what have we seen in man's history where that's been the case? Man is always sort of wrong. You know, no one's ever 100% bulletproof, especially when it's looking at data or something like that.
Well, it's the same with the theory of evolution, too. They call it a theory, and yet they've never once found a link fossil between the earliest life forms and us. That should be still called a hypothesis if they were just being honest with the terminology there.
Yeah.
Well, even like with one example that always comes out with situations like this is the geocentric theory, which is, people for eons thought the Earth was the center of our solar system. Galileo thought differently. The Catholic Church killed people over this. That's what happens when science becomes mixed up with politics. It's not just about science anymore. It's about believing something. And if you don't, you're ostracized or criticized or in some places killed for it. When it's, and over time, of course, that seems foolish to us in our day and age. Of the barbarism of the Dark Ages where you get killed for not believing in science. But, I mean, if you look at the vehemence at which Brett Stevens is being attacked here, it's kind of the same thing, just in a different method.
Yeah, they say that the column angered scores of environmentalists and climate change activists. Many took to social media with promises to cancel their subscriptions.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So, well, you never know. I don't know what the real numbers are on this. You know, was it 10 people? Was it a lot? It's hard to say. But But a lot of people do hold the idea of climate change very dearly, particularly if they are environmentalists or somebody that's kind of made their name promoting it. Because then it's not really about the science anymore. It's kind of about the personal vanity of it all. You don't want to be wrong.
How is it really science if most all of the scientists who look into it have already reached their conclusion before looking at any of the data? They already have decided in their minds and in their hearts that climate change is going to be a reality even before they look at what they're testing. So it's not like they're going into it with a clean slate and an open mind about whatever the data could present.
Yeah, it's interesting that they... I wonder if you were to look at the New York Times in general, how many columns show up where there are a fair number of people that say, I'm upset and I'm going to cancel my subscription, but it doesn't usually make the headlines. I bet that happens, especially if it's... you know, they have some pretty outlandish pieces in there, some pretty strong opinion pieces, and I bet it does irritate a lot of people. But they happen to pick out this one particular situation to amplify. But it would be interesting to see those numbers too.
Well, I think people who don't agree with the New York Times, they just don't read it anymore because they have very clear bent in a lot of their pieces. But I think one person brought out yesterday that I read about this is, I think it's an opinion column that Brett Stevens has. It's an opinion.
You say whatever you want.
He's not saying it's dogmatic truth. It's saying it's his opinion. And even what he's saying, he's not disproving. He's just saying that data is wrong sometimes. It's been proven to be wrong, and that that's just the way it works, and just have a little more humility as we view these things. And I think that's just good. As you mentioned, it's advice on how to approach it. He's not saying it's false. So just that there's that side of it too. But even Inconvenient Truth, is that's the thing that Al Gore did, right? most of the data that hits in that has been proven to be wrong.
Is he making a new one now because the old one was so thoroughly debunked?
I'm not sure. He might be. I didn't hear about that. But anyway, like, he won a Nobel Prize for that.
Right.
But most of it's been proven to be completely false. So I mean, and people like were worshiping him. It was such a big deal, but it was all been proven to be wrong. So I think there's a good track record of this sort of thing that Brett Stevens warns us against.
I thought I saw a headline where Mr. Gore asked for $1 trillion to battle climate change. That's a lot of money. I don't know what they're going to do. Like, what are you going to do with that money? But
well, even I remember when I was in school debating this in class. And because if you look at how Al Gore lives, he flies on the jet and all these things. And I'm like, well, he's polluting the environment more than just the average person is with his lifestyle. And my teacher's like, well, he buys carbon credits, so it's okay. Like, it doesn't make it okay. He's still doing it. Like, buying carbon credits, you're putting money into it, but you're still physically polluting the environment. Like, in the way that he warned us not to. And it just blew my mind how they, like, oh, he buys carbon credits, you can't criticize him. It's like, what are you talking about?
Right. Yeah. You can pollute just as long as you pay for it. Make sure you pay for it. Interesting. I don't know where that $1 trillion would come from or where it would go, but that's what he's
asking. I have a feeling he'd keep a lot of it.
He's doing okay, from what I understand. This is an interesting story here from CBS Baltimore. Baltimore's been in the headlines over the last couple of years, a lot of violence, protesting, and so forth. And they're having a really tough time over there. The mayor is asking FBI for help with investigating city crime, rising murder rate. Oh, it hasn't gotten any better. It's gotten worse. Violence in Baltimore has reached a crisis level, with the number of killings shattering a 20-year high for this early in the year. And Baltimore's mayor was pretty blunt, said, I'm calling on all the assistance we can possibly get, because I can't imagine going into our summer months with our crime rate where it is today. What's that going to look like by the end of the summer? And that was Mayor Catherine Pugh. The question remains, will more FBI help effectively stop the bloodshed? The mayor believes she doesn't have time to wait. We are looking for all the help that we can get, she says. This week, Baltimore reached a grim milestone, 100 murders before the end of April. It's the first time that's happened since 1998. So I don't know. I haven't seen too much about what's going on with the police there. I know they protested against the police, but and now they want the FBI's help or other help as well. I don't know. It seems like you could use more police.
It doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of fear of committing crimes there, which indicates that maybe the police should have a little bit more leeway to actually be trusted to do their jobs, at least, if not provide more police as well.
Yeah, I'd like to. I mean, they did have this write-up in CBS Baltimore, which is interesting. But it would be good if they say the media tracked some of these cities a little more. Like, okay, there were protests that occurred, and now how many ever months down the road, where are we today, and what's the cause for it? Like, we don't see enough of those stories, at least not from mainstream media.
Well, yeah, I think especially with the high profile court case there. With the deaths of someone and a lot of them being acquitted and protests. And I think that was the same mayor who said, give them space to protest, don't intervene. Now she wants help because the situation has spiraled out of control since then. So this is interesting. I think from what I understand about Baltimore, from what I've read over the past few months, the police haven't been shrunken down in size or anything like that, but they've just been, they have to wear body cams now and all those sorts of things. They've just been much more timid in confronting those problem parts of Baltimore because of what happened, which makes sense. I mean, that's around the country, but you can see the effects of it. And this is just another example of what happens when the police are not empowered to do their job, or they're afraid of legal action against them.
Yeah, you don't see a lot of protests against the murder count in Baltimore or Chicago, at least not that I've seen. You know, where are the people in the streets protesting it? They come out in force when it's against the establishment in some way, but not now.
Well, just this weekend, it was Science March Day or something like that. The Science March, or thousands of people around the world marching in the streets for science, whatever that means exactly. But
were they for it or against it?
Well, people dress up as a Tyrannosaurus Rex holding up a sign for like says for science. I don't understand that. But anyway, people unite on those sorts of things. But in like Chicago, Baltimore, other places, you have these terrible murders going on, and there's no civil rights group is standing up for those people, the victims. Who are left really without anything.
Yeah, I suppose if you're an officer, you've got a choice. Like you could go and try to stop something, or you could go pick up the body.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know if they have to make those choices, or maybe the calls don't come in. I don't know how that works, but not a good situation there in Baltimore. One other note here, as we head into summer, the thing we all probably like the least is mosquitoes. And, of course, then that brings up the fear of Zika. This is from Fox News. As Zika season approaches, states step up efforts to combat the virus. In 2016, Zika, which is known to cause neurological defects in developing fetuses, was found in pregnant women in 44 states across the country and caused large-scale outbreaks in Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, American Samoa, Florida, and Texas. A CDC report released earlier this month found that 1 in 10 pregnant women with Zika gave birth to a child with serious birth defects. So 10% there. In the U.S. alone last year, 77 babies died in the womb due to Zika, while 51 babies were born with Zika-related birth defects. A warm winter, they say, in many of the states heavily affected by Zika could mean the survival of more eggs of the mosquito species that transmits the virus, of course, known as Aedes aegypti. If anyone knew that name, that scientific name, I probably said it wrong. But that's the type of mosquito anyway. I can't tell them apart. They all bite me. Last month, federal officials at the Center for the Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta told health officials from six states hard hit by the virus that Zika funding envisioned to last 5 years will run out this summer. So they set aside money for 5 years, and it's all...
What is that, a year, maybe?
Yeah, just about. Texas is recommending that all pregnant women in the six counties where Zika-carrying mosquitoes live get tested for the virus, and is also asking any pregnant women who have a rash and at least one other Zika symptom, fever, joint pain, and eye redness, to get tested as well. So summer returns and Zika still with us.
Oof. Yeah, it's I think a lot of us forgot about it because since the Olympic Games last year and that big outbreak in Brazil, I think it's in our rearview mirrors, but it's still there. And I'm not sure if we've had any success getting rid of anything carried by mosquitoes in the past, because any time we've tried something, we've created more problems.
Right.
With the DDT and that kind of stuff. So I know it's just a really tough situation, and especially with a warmer summer, warmer winter, nature's not helping us either.
Yeah. So anyway, something to think about, I guess, especially if you're, you know, pregnant or thinking about going that direction. So it's something to think about at least. Trumpet Daily Radio Show is coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Make sure you listen for that with your host, Stephen Fleury. Also, stop and check out thetrumpet.com. Top story today by our very own Abraham Blondeau. Royal Navy to lose amphibious capabilities. We're going to talk about that a little bit more coming up here in a bit. Also related to that, a couple other stories. Is the Royal Navy obsolete, and the aircraft carrier that had no planes, by Joel Hilliker? So those are some other ones that you can check out related to that. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. Grant, you've got a write-up here, which is really interesting. It's from the Washington Post. A little life hack, I guess. Prioritizing these three things will improve your life and maybe even save it. The three secrets.
Yes, this is actually coverage of the TED Talks that took place last week, that international conference, where they pretty much present a lot of innovative ideas, some of them being a robot that could outperform students on college exams. I'm not sure if that's really that impressive anymore. But there's also some other things like an ultraviolet light that could kill superbugs. So obviously some huge innovations coming forward at this TED conference. And yet really some of the ones that hit home for a lot of the audience there seem to be the more simple tips. And that's what this article has here. The first one is face-to-face social interaction leads to a longer life. And they say that women who live on average 6 years longer actually do place higher priority on spending time with their friends. So that would make sense.
Yeah, that one was really interesting to me. And from what I saw, they said that even seemed to have a greater impact on the length of life as opposed to even some other health risks, you know, that you would, like heart issues and things like
even
that.
Even like smoking and drinking and heart problems. And if you try to exercise to offset those things don't even impact a person's longevity like face-to-face social interaction. And that's not even talking about spending hours together, even if it just means making more eye contact, smiling, talking for a couple minutes, even giving someone a high five. It's almost like it releases the right chemicals and also gets rid of stress.
Yeah. How much longer would we live if we all high-fived more?
High fives are the greatest thing.
If you get them, sometimes you miss and then you feel bad because you got to go back and read. No, come on now. Get it right. You go too low, go too high, don't get it quite right. But yeah, that one was really interesting to me. And it is, I guess that is true. If you do think about the genders, it does usually kind of go that way, I guess. Especially as people get older, it seems like. Mm-hmm. Guys tend to be a little more quiet and the ladies tend to talk. Good, bad, or otherwise, but apparently it's helping longevity.
Well, especially in light of what we talked about last week with screen time. I think like they said, they're not sure how that will affect this generation, but that's another good point to support why you should get off your phone and just, even on, if you're sitting on a bus, read a book or just look at people, because you might live longer than just staring at your phone the whole time.
Yeah. If somebody says, why are you staring at me? You say, well, I'm just worried about my lifespan. And they'll be like, if you don't stop staring at me, you might be worried about your lifespan.
Actually, that was a perfect segue talking about screen time. That was the second point that was brought up. It was about knowing when to turn off your smartphone actually can enrich your life.
Yeah, that's something that I'm proud to say I did that last night. Not necessarily turn it off, but like it was in the evening and I had that impulse to go get my phone. And I thought to myself, I have really no reason to do that. And so I didn't. I'm trying to make a better habit of that. So, you know, because I've read studies before where it just says you sleep better if mm-hmm. you kind of leave it alone at night and you're not on it as much.
Right. And that is a huge thing. It talks about here how face-to-face interactions are obviously far more beneficial than texting someone or emailing somebody. It's also more beneficial to be, in person in a meeting instead of watching the same content on a video. So obviously, being in person with others actually does impact the brain in a better way.
Yeah. I think if we stop and think about that, I think I always feel better after I have a little conversation with somebody, typically. Mm. It didn't go well. but usually, yeah, you do feel better. You feel more energized, I think. And it's just good input into your brain coming from another brain.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little different than just staring at your phone or the computer or whatever.
Yeah, and apparently there's a new technology out there that was brought up at the TED Talk that it basically, if you turn on your out-of-office auto-reply on your email saying, I'm not here right now, but I'll get back to you when I'm, back in the office, it actually sends a notification back to the sender of that email saying, this email's actually been deleted. So basically what that does is prevent people who are out of the office on vacation or spending time with family on the weekends from checking emails, which is a huge part of actually too much screen time, the tyranny of email, it's called.
Yeah, there is always that sort of, thought in the back of your head, like maybe I got an email from somebody I need to check. And some people do, depending on what they do. But for me, it's usually, one or two relevant ones and about 100 advertisements. So I don't need to be checking it as often, I don't think.
And the point that was also brought out there is even if emails are important, if it's extremely urgent, there's always a way for someone to contact us even without immediate access to the emails. I mean, we have each other's phone numbers. We know where we live and things like that. So if it really is super urgent, an email, being able to check an email every 5 minutes doesn't necessarily matter so much.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. So that more face-to-face interaction helps get your life improved and maybe save it, and then also less time with the phones and so forth.
Yeah. I thought those were two great points, but also things that we've talked a lot about on this show, about how talking to people face-to-face, not phone snubbing or fubbing, as it's called, is important, and also limiting the smartphone, because a smartphone is something that it doesn't really have an end. You could scroll that thing forever. There's the internet, which is an endless resource.
Yeah.
It's not like a book or a movie that has an end point. It actually can go on forever. So those are some things we've talked about before. The third point I actually thought, though, was something new, something I haven't really thought of as much, especially with the way people present this topic now. It says here, chasing meaning, not happiness, is what really matters. So what we always hear is that, just follow your heart, follow your dreams, try to find whatever makes you happy. But really, that doesn't make people happy. If people are not producing or benefiting society or themselves or others in some way, it's not actually providing much happiness at all.
Yeah, I thought that was a really interesting point that I hadn't thought of either. Because they were saying, happiness is a fleeting feeling. It comes and it goes, and it's not it's not the same probably as, I guess, being content. It's sort of an emotional feeling. And then they made the point, too, that being sad isn't like the lack of being happy or the opposite of being happy. It's not having fulfillment, really.
Mm-hmm.
In which I thought, well, that's a really interesting point. I hadn't thought much about that.
Yeah, there is definitely a difference between happiness and joy. Happiness can usually be triggered by maybe having an exciting event to look forward to in the evening, or maybe someone is going to give us a gift. Something like that can cause a fleeting moment of happiness. But if you think about trying to apply that to life and constantly chasing happiness, that means, spending all your money on entertainment and other such things. Things that will maybe spark that fleeting moment of happiness, but then it's gone as soon as your money's gone.
Yeah, I think there's probably a list of things that we all tend to think would make us happy if we had it, unlimited money or a lot more money, mm-hmm. and different things. But then you do see people that get that, athletes or celebrities and things. And a lot of times at the end of the day, they're just not very happy people. Mm-hmm. A lot of times it made them more miserable than ever. You don't think it would when you're on this side of it. Like, oh, come on now, $1 million, that couldn't hurt anybody. But, it doesn't lead to long-term happiness.
Yeah, it can be a benefit, but it does seem like a lot of the time it's more of a curse. Obviously, without a productive lifestyle, having all the money in the world, it's just going to lead to a lot of vices, a lot of, you know, character destroying habits. So that's not something necessarily that is going to automatically bring really true content or fulfillment or something like that.
Yeah, a lot of the people that have done very well for themselves in business and other things, and they tend to seem like they're, you know, staying out of the, all the vices and things. Mm-hmm. A lot of times they put a lot of their money towards a cause of some kind, like, because they are seeking that meaning. They are setting up foundations and they are trying to better society in a way that they feel it will improve. And there's been examples of people doing that. And I think they've kind of figured that out, that, well, okay, I've got everything I want and then some. Now I need to do something that has purpose and benefit somebody else. And that's it's a noble aspiration.
Yeah, that's actually described here as transcendence, a feeling of being a part of something bigger than oneself. A lot of people derive that from being a part of church services or something like that, or maybe an art group, some other sort of hobby group that it's like you're developing a skill within yourself, but also sort of interacting with a bigger group of people who are striving toward the same goal.
Yeah. Interesting. Three things that can help improve your life, maybe even save it. More interaction with human beings.
Face to face.
Face to face. Less interaction with your screens, and seeking meaning and purpose as opposed to chasing the fleeting excitement of a momentary happiness.
Yes.
Yeah, those all sound like pretty practical points.
Straight out of the TED Talks International Conference last week. Yeah. Those are some really interesting videos. I always find those stimulating.
Yeah, I thought I've seen a few and they've been great. Obviously, depending on the topic,
right.
but they can be really interesting. So, yeah, I think that'll be helpful to all of us if we can remember some of those. Grant, thanks for bringing that to us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. And we have a live link to it at thetrumpet.com. Thanks for joining us today on those various platforms. And again, if you miss any of the programs here on KPCG, you can get the archives at kpcg.fm and at thetrumpet.com as well. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau here today. And Abraham, before we get into your story, you might find this interesting from Canada. This is from Heat Street. Canada man ordered to surrender offensive Star Trek license plate. People get personalized license plates, and I guess sometimes they're offensive. I don't know. I'm trying to think if I ever saw one that was offensive. I can't recall that I have, but
I see a lot of embarrassing ones, but I've never seen one that was offensive towards me.
I spend my time, you know, sometimes when you're driving, you see some, and sometimes it's a real, actually, it's a fun game for the family because you're trying to figure out what it's supposed to say, because sometimes it's a little bit of a riddle to unpack what it says. But in this case, in Canada, this guy had a Star Trek-inspired license plate. Now, people were offended because they're not Star Trek fans and they didn't get the reference. I wouldn't have gotten it either. It says a Canadian man's Star Trek-inspired license plate has been revoked after his public insurance company received complaints that it was offensive to Indigenous people. The 2-year-old plate, which reads ASIMIL8, which is assimilate, is a sly reference to the Borg, evil aliens in Star Trek who, quote, assimilate their prey and go by the motto, resistance is futile.
So, yes.
I don't know anything about Star Trek, but that's what it is, apparently. So this guy's a Star Trek fan, and he's got that on there. Manitoba, he's in Manitoba, and he was informed by an agent from the Manitoba Public Insurance on Wednesday that they had received complaints from two people about the word assimilate, which they claimed is offensive to minorities. He was then served a letter informing him that it has been brought to the attention of this office that the personalized plate assimilate is considered offensive, and he was ordered to surrender it immediately. So they assimilated him, apparently.
Yeah, that's I know exactly what he's talking about there, assimilating the Borg and all that. Okay. But anyway, I wouldn't have necessarily, if I read it, I wouldn't have necessarily pointed to Star Trek as my first thought. But yeah, Manitoba is probably the worst place to have something like that because it is, the whole province was created for Indigenous people in Canada. So I can see how they could find the fence to it. But at the same time, the intent isn't to offend them. And also, it is a free country, and he paid money for it. It's not just any old license plate. So I don't know. I can see how people could find that offensive, but they're just reading insults into it. He wasn't intending to harm anyone with it.
Always have to be careful what you put on your cars. You see some interesting bumper stickers and different ones. I saw one the other day. It was sort of odd. It was a guy driving a Jeep, and he had a decal on the back window. It was a stick drawing of a Jeep, and it appeared to be running people over. I don't know if you've seen that before. Like, somebody was running from it, and then somebody appeared to be under it, and then somebody had been like thrown over the top. Unless I didn't understand it, and I asked my wife. I said, "Is that saying that his Jeep like will run people over?" Like, I didn't understand what he was getting at there.
Yeah, just don't jaywalk in front of him.
Apparently,
I guess.
Yeah,
but there's always some weird ones. It's always funny because you'll see them and it's like some really tough looking stickers and you look in, it's like a young 20-year-old girl driving this huge truck. You're like, well, it doesn't make any sense.
It's her dad's. It's her brother's truck.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to be careful. You don't want to cause offense if you don't have to. You've got an interesting write-up here from Extreme Reach. I have not heard of this before, but I saw the picture and it was pretty interesting. Scientists unravel the mystery of Antarctica's blood falls. It's a like waterfall or something.
Yeah.
And it looks like blood. I mean, the picture really does. I hadn't heard of it before, but they've figured out why this happens.
Yeah. It's a glacier in Antarctica. And coming from it, there's this flow of red coming out. It looks like a blood flowing out everywhere from the glacier. And their opening line is, most of us, if we encountered what was obviously a waterfall of blood, would turn tail and run.
Yes. I would.
It looks terrifying, like this river of blood. But it was discovered by Griffith Taylor, and he discovered it in the early 1900s. And it is, I think you should look up pictures if you can to our listeners. It's just really cool to look at. It's a flow of red liquid from the Taylor Glacier in Antarctica. And this has been perplexing to scientists until now. So for over 100 years. And basically, Taylor, when he found it, he thought it could have been algae, because some algae blooms, they're red, and it can distort the water and make it look like it's red. And some algae can survive in Arctic temperatures. So that was his theory, but they never found any algae there. And now they finally figured out what it is. So it's not blood. They confirmed that. But what it is it's rust. So they actually did some pretty cool techniques here to figure this out. And basically, it's a huge glacier, and they had to look underneath it to try to figure out where the water was coming from. So they use radio sonar, which is they bounce radio waves underground that come back, and they can, depending on what the reading looks like, they can figure out what's underneath it. And they found out that there's a lake underneath the glacier, and it has high levels of iron. And when the iron comes into contact with the air in the waterfall, it makes it look red.
Yeah.
So it's just a dissolved iron or rust in the water.
That's really interesting. So, and it's been doing this for years, obviously. Like you said, it was found many years ago. And it just keeps having this water flow pretty constantly out of it.
Yeah, this has been... we've only known about it for hundreds of, or about 100 years, but... It would have been doing that for as long as there was iron in the water.
Yeah.
That's the same reason why Mars is red. It's the same principle, the iron rusts in the air. And so what they also found, though, is there's this subterranean lake, but they also found there's this huge system of underground rivers in Antarctica that flow under the glaciers and under all the frozen ice. And the reason they're not frozen yet is they have such a high amount of salt in them that they can't freeze. And so there's this huge network under Antarctica of rivers and lakes. And this blood falls is just one place where it comes out, but it has all that iron in it. So it makes it look like blood. And I think this is really interesting because Antarctica, we don't know too much about it, but obviously there's lots of resources and water underneath Antarctica and they're resources we can't really tap into yet.
Yeah. Yeah. I was wondering about that. Like what the, you know, if you could, there's some benefit to it, if they could use it in some way or something like that. Yeah. You can imagine years ago before people would, maybe have the scientific understanding, like what the assumptions would be as to why this was happening. You could see all kinds of really bizarre assumptions about what was going on over there.
Well, yeah, I'm sure when Griffith Taylor went back, I think he's from England, there would have been lots of different doomsday associations with blood falls and all these other different things people thought of at the time. But yeah, I think about a month ago or so on the show, we talked about this new osmosis filter they're making that can turn seawater into drinking water.
Yeah.
And so if they have that technology, they could harness all this water in Antarctica too, and use it for drinking water if someone got control of Antarctica. Because right now it's everyone has a little chunk of it. So I think this whole story, it's I think it's interesting from a science standpoint, but it also shows you that as time goes on, places like this are going to become very competitive. They get control of everything that's underneath all the ice.
Yeah. Yeah. Who knows what's all down there? Very, very interesting to see. Pretty interesting. That's from Extreme Reach. Scientists unravel the mystery of Antarctica's blood falls. And, you know, it's interesting, too, because the UK was very, very much involved in exploration up there. And that was quite a, you could become quite famous years ago, centuries ago, if you went up there and explored and then came back and had data and tales and so forth, and then hopefully get somebody to sponsor you to go back again. So if you can come back with a pretty amazing story like that, if people believed you, you become a little bit of a celebrity.
Yeah, well, it was the last frontier to be explored. Everywhere else on the Earth had pretty much been covered, so it was the last place where people could explore. And I think the most famous Antarctic explorer is Ernest Shackleton. And ironically, he's probably the one with the least success. He failed at all his objectives, but had some amazing stories, some harrowing tales from that I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar with. But yeah, it was just fascinating. And reading their journals, a lot of it's boring scientific measurements I don't really understand.
Yep.
But when they come to a new place, they try to explain what they can see. It's like a mountain, huge mountains of snow falling into each other and big shards of ice, and they can't really explain it because there's no other place on Earth that looks like Antarctica. So it'd just be really fascinating to go there and be able to see it.
Yeah, when those explorers came back, they'd spent a lot of time compiling their data and the descriptions, and a lot of times those were just bestsellers.
Yeah,
it was really fascinating for people to read about these places that they had never been and probably never could be, and you don't have photos of them.
Yeah,
so you have to just kind of, you know, use your imagination there. Really interesting. You've got the top story today on thetrumpet.com, and we're going to talk about this a little bit. Royal Navy to lose amphibious capabilities. Possible cuts will leave Britain incapable of the offensive. And so there's a couple other stories there as well that relate to that have talked about what's going on there. Is the Royal Navy obsolete and the aircraft carrier that had no planes? Those two articles tie in as well. And so what's happening there with the Royal Navy?
Yeah, so I think thetrumpet.com has been covering for years the decline of the Royal Navy and how the government keeps cutting off some of its most important ships just to save money. And so this is along the same lines, except it has a pretty amazing historical parallel that we should draw some lessons from. And so 35 years ago this year, actually right now, 35 years ago, the Royal Navy's task force, Operation Corporate, was on the way from Great Britain to the Falklands because the Argentines had invaded the Falkland Islands on the very southern tip of South America, had taken it over, and so Margaret Thatcher ordered a task force there to take it back. And so 35 years ago, that was going on, and at the front of this task force were two carriers, the HMS Hermes and the HMS Invincible, and they were instrumental in the Britain being able to take back the Falklands. And the main part of the campaign was an amphibious assault on the islands, and it was led by the 3rd Commandos with the paratroopers and the special forces. And what's amazing is Britain was outnumbered the whole time, but they went on the attack, and they were able to roll back the Argentinians and have a pretty decisive victory in that war. And so, and it was what was on display was the amphibious tactics, the aircraft carriers, the Harrier jets, all these really unique pieces of the British Army were really instrumental in the victory. Yet, ironically, in 1982, right before the war broke out, Margaret Thatcher's government was slated to sell off those aircraft carriers and to start cutting back on the Royal Navy's amphibious fleet. So all these like little landing carriers that can take troops from a ship to the beaches. So they wanted to cut all those out because they were broke and they needed the money. But the Falklands War saved those aircraft carriers because they ended up needing them. And so that's what happened 35 years ago. And that's the exact same thing that's happening today. The conservative government today wants to sell off Britain's last aircraft carrier, the HMS Ocean, and all its amphibious capability.
Yeah, very fortunate that 35 years ago they had a use for those, you know, before they sold them.
Yeah.
As opposed to already having sold them, they would have been in a tough situation otherwise. But you don't always, or they're not always going to be that fortunate.
Yeah, exactly. It's something I think this government should learn from. I mean, Margaret Thatcher never shied away from using force, and even her government needed to cut down on the Royal Navy, or thought they needed to. So I don't think there's much of a chance that the Royal Navy has for not cutting it now under Theresa May. So I think what's also interesting is that at the time, Britain didn't think they would ever fight another war. But all of a sudden, the Falklands came up and they needed to fight on their own because the United States did not want Britain to fight that war. In fact, Ronald Reagan called Margaret Thatcher and said that you shouldn't fight against Argentina, even though Argentina had a fascist military dictatorship. But America was afraid it would damage their trade relations. And so Margaret Thatcher went forward anyway. And if she had sold those carriers, the only way America could ever do anything was, or sorry, the only way the UK could ever fight another war again was with someone else's help, America or France or someone else. But this isn't the first time this has happened. And this is from a book called Amphibious Warfare. But basically, they bring out that almost in the last 100 years, everyone said you don't need amphibious capability anymore. And this is a quote from that book. They said, before both world wars, serious observers claimed that opposed landings would be impossible. They were wrong. In 1949, General Omar Bradley, a veteran of Normandy, stated that he did not believe that major landings would be possible in a nuclear year, in a nuclear age. Within less than a year, the 1st U.S. Marine Division successfully conducted a major opposed landing at Incheon. In 1981, the British Minister of Defense, John Nott, conducted a major defense review on the basis that the Royal Navy did not require specialist amphibious ships and that the aircraft carrier HMS Invincible should be sold. 1 year later, these same ships proved vital in the successful campaign to recover the Falkland Islands. So this is something that has gone on for a long time. People thinking that they'll never have to fight another war, basically, or use these kinds of tactics. But each time they've been proven to be wrong. And so if Britain does sell off the HMS Ocean, which is their last carrier, they're also wanting to make the commando units much smaller than they are right now. It would pretty much leave Britain incapable of fighting a war without the United States' help. And this comes right at the time when a lot of nations are being more aggressive. Spain keeps, they're being very aggressive to try to get back Gibraltar. Argentina is being really aggressive right now on the Falklands. Britain might have to send a task force to Iran or North Korea possibly to support the United States. So right when all these wars could happen, they're thinking of cutting off the most important ship in the Royal Navy.
Yeah, and of course Brexit, to where they're isolated. Not that Europe would have probably agreed with them on some sort of military maneuver, but still, you'd think that when you're pulling away from the union you've been part of to some extent, you'd want to bolster your own defenses. Is it nationally, do they not want to, or are they just out of money, or is it a combination?
Well, I think it's a combination. They are building two new aircraft carriers, the Queen Elizabeth class right now, and they're three times the size of the HMS Ocean. They're quite large, but they won't be ready until the 2020s. So there's a look. There could be about a 4 to 5 year gap where they don't have an aircraft carrier, and that 4 or 5 years could be really dangerous, because that's when all their enemies could take advantage of Britain, because they know they can't do anything about it. And then a lot of it's because of the welfare state. Britain is a welfare state, basically, and that the welfare state eats up the money from the army and the navy. And so that's basically what's happening now. And if they can't afford the HMS Ocean, which is actually quite cheap to maintain, it's not expensive, we have to wonder if they can even afford to have two aircraft carriers three times the size, if they can't afford to have one small one now. So there's a lot of questions regarding the budget and their future. And if Britain, they're basically forfeiting their role as a big power by not having an aircraft carrier. And they're doing this based on that they'll have two aircraft carriers in the future, but I doubt they'll even be able to afford them.
Yeah.
And they're planning to outfit them with F-35 Lightnings, which are very expensive. So they're going to have to foot the bill sometime. And I don't think it makes sense to get rid of a very cost-efficient ship when your country's under threat right now.
Yeah. Well, according to a write-up by the National Interest, and this is from 2014, so a little bit of time there, but they rank the most powerful naval forces in the world. And at that time, anyway, they had the UK at number 4, even though, as they say, the list catches the Royal Navy at a historic ebb in firepower. And so the United States was number 1, China, and then Russia, then the UK, then Japan. I don't know if that list has varied at all since that time, but that's one of the write-ups that they have there. So it was interesting. They don't have much about Europe, so I wonder what Europe's got, if much of anything. I'm not sure.
Well, I think Europe, one problem they have is they do have a small navy. No country has really prioritized it because the U.S. has always been there. And so a lot of nations have a small navy because the U.S. has been so big and dominant. They don't really need one because they're allied with them. So I think if nations become more estranged from the United States, we could see a big buildup in navy capability. And that's what China's been doing. They just launched their second aircraft carrier last week. And then I saw an article just, I think last week too, where Germany's starting to address their small navy because it's pretty weak even compared to the Royal Navy.
Yeah. Well, it'd be interesting too, because a lot of times it also has to do with your industrial capability and how fast you could ramp up.
Yeah.
You know, that's a big part of things as well.
Well, and especially if countries like Britain are selling their aircraft carriers, it's a good chance for someone to buy it. And Brazil, right, they're thinking of selling it to Brazil, but it will go to the best bidder. And I'm sure someone in Europe could buy it up too if they wanted.
Yeah, I was wondering that. Like, who do you sell it to? And when you're handing over the official documentation, do you nervously say, like, now you're not going to use this against us, right? You're selling weapons to somebody else. I know that goes on, but it just seems like a gamble, to say the least. Speaking of the British Navy and military, movie coming out this summer. On Dunkirk.
Yes.
You've seen the previews for that?
Yeah, it had really positive reviews. Some people think it could be the best war movie since Saving Private Ryan. So it looks like it could be really well done.
Yeah, I just saw the previews for it yesterday, as a matter of fact. And so you never know. You never know when they start getting into some of the historical stuff there. But yeah, at least it's a topic worth talking about. I don't know if they'll talk about it in a good way or a bad way, or show it, you know, in a good way or a bad way, but it's worth getting into. We have a couple of Kia David programs on that, at least one, on the miracle of Dunkirk. I don't know if they'll talk about it from, or the movie will show that side of it, you know, because for many years the British did believe that that was a miraculous situation there at Dunkirk, but we'll see what they say.
Yeah, well, I think from what I understand about the movie, it follows three different people. One's a soldier, one's in the ships, and one's in an airplane, and it follows them throughout the evacuation, so... Seems like it's well done. There have been a couple people I've seen who criticize some of the historical inaccuracies, and they're just basically like putting the wrong ship in the wrong place and that kind of thing. That's not a big deal. But hopefully it's paints a true picture, and then it also doesn't try to twist history or make or apologize for anything, I guess.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see, because there's that Churchill movie that came out or is coming out.
Yeah.
And so they're getting into some of the those people from those time periods. And but if they can do the Dunkirk one okay, I mean, at least maybe it'll get that history into some people's minds. Maybe they go back and read about it or something.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting. Yeah. It's I guess they ran out of superhero movies. They always have to come up with something to make a movie about. So something like that seems like it could be okay, but we'll hold off judgment until it actually comes out. Make sure you listen for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Also, there's Just the Best Literature Today. That's a new episode. And stop and check out thetrumpet.com. The feature story is the one we talked about a little bit there, but there's a lot more in there to look at. Royal Navy to lose amphibious capabilities. Always makes me think of a frog for some reason. Related to that is the Royal Navy obsolete and the aircraft carrier that had no planes. You can find that and a lot more at thetrumpet.com. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau, thanks for spending some of your Monday with us. Have a great rest of your day, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.